This project on individuality was first approved by the Board of Trustees in 2009 as part of the strategic planning process. We ran an e-conference in 2010 where we had about 30 participants over a two-month period. And I hope you all know we have a conference coming up in Montenegro in June where we'll actually be physically meeting. This program today is intended kind of as a warm-up to that, and to hear, to present some of the issues that to be explored, and to hear back from you about the types of issues that you would like to cover under the project. We'll have four speakers covering about a little more than half the program, and then we've tried to leave as much time as possible for feedback and discussion from all of you. This is a kind of provocative theme, I think. The idea that one man can, or one person, man for short, one human being can change the world. And throughout history, we have many instances of that. And this is just a very few drawn from a great many different fields. From religion, from politics, from military, from arts, from sciences, from literature, from many different fields, from the social sector, just to illustrate that almost in a remarkable way, a single person seems to be able to make a disproportionate contribution to the lives of all of us. In a world of billions, from time to time, we see one person making a huge difference. Throughout history, we remind ourselves of radical. But of course, these are only a few of the millions of people who have helped build the world and make it what it is today. Often, these contributions become recognized long after the individual is no longer with us. In the case of Copernicus, at the time when he proposed his idea of a heliocentric world or universe, there were probably only a dozen heliocentrists, at least known heliocentrists in the world at large. About 70 years after his death, it finally became obvious that his theory had a tremendous challenge to conventional theology, and that the efforts of the church to suppress it only succeeded in popularizing it and making it very much more known. Not all of these individuals that make a remarkable contribution come from high society or head prominent organizations, or even known historically. Many of them go unrecognized. A middle-aged black woman named Rosa Parks sparked the American Civil Liberties Movement by refusing to move to the back of a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. And there are many instances like that. And of course, when we talk about the outstanding contribution of individuals, we don't mean to say that any of these people are ideal human beings or perfect in any sense. We shouldn't make the mistake of glorifying their achievements so far that we fail to realize that even the greatest individuals can be really very ordinary human beings in other respects. Martin Luther ushered in the Reformation. At that time, he denounced Copernicus as an upstart astrologer who strove to show that the world revolves around the heavens. He said, "The fool wishes to reverse the entire science of astronomy." So expertise or accomplishment in one field is no guarantee of accomplishment or high achievement in many fields. Newton himself had an abiding interest in biblical chronology at a time when the prevailing belief was the world is only a few thousand years old. In the course of the conference, not only today, but I hope as we go forward, we will look at a number of very interesting questions about the theme of individuality. What do we mean by it? Are there some common characteristics that these people that I am labeling individuals have in common that sets them apart from others? What does it take to make an outstanding contribution to society? What precisely is the relationship between an outstanding individual and the rest of the collective of which he is a part, from which he comes and which he influences? Do societies differ in their tendency to give rise to individuals? Is it on account of cultural differences, or does it reflect differences in stages of development or periods of development that might be not linear stages but cyclical stages? What can we learn from recent history about the means by which societies actively foster and promote the development of individuality in their members? Is humanity in the process of becoming more individualized? These are just a few of the seminal questions that I hope we'll be able to explore today in Montenegro in our upcoming activities. I'd like to put forth a few propositions just to think about, and I'll talk to them briefly, very briefly this today. First, the mature individual, which is what I am referring to as individuality, represents the highest present achievement of human culture, and perhaps of nature in its evolution. I'd like to suggest that individuality is evolving, that humanity is becoming more individualized, and that the evolution of the individual is a key to the continuous evolution and sustainability of the human community. And therefore, that learning how to actively and successfully promote the development of human capital in general, which I hope Eva will talk to, and the emergence of individuality in particular, may be the single most important challenge for ensuring humanity's collective future. But first, to the very difficult question of what do we mean by individuality? And it's particularly difficult because the word in English is so ambiguous and a subject of so much potential confusion. The dictionary gives two or three basic definitions of individual. The first one, we use it in the common language every day to refer to a single or separate or a particular person. That is not the way in which I'm using the term today. The second is a person who is striking, unusual, distinctive, or original. That is much closer to the meaning that I have in mind. The second confusion comes from the word individualism, very widely used today. Especially, it started about 500 years ago with the Italian Renaissance, and we have lived through a period, an age of individualism. And that typically we mean somebody with a sense of independence and self-reliance, which may be self-centered and egoistic pursuit of self-interest without regard for its impact on society. That's what many people think of when they think of individualism. This is often the result of the fact that people are differentiated to the extent that they feel separate from everyone else, no longer part of it. And then this third term, which comes much closer to the meaning I want to emphasize, psychologists use the term individuation to refer to an individual as one in an advanced stage of personality formation, characterized by distinguishing qualities, characteristics, and values. This is a process of development of consciousness, as Jung said, that's made possible in freedom, by which an unformed person develops into a unique personality with a sense of both social responsibility and individual responsibility. Now, I think it's clear that these three terms are closely interrelated, and that's one of the things that's going to make our discussions very interesting, because the recognition of the ordinary separate individual may be an essential step in the process of developing individualism and developing individuation. It may well be that these three different meanings or connotations represent three different stages of human development. And I hope we'll have time to, I'm sure we'll have time to explore this sometime in the future. Individual cultures may provide the freedom that encourages individuation or individualism, but mature individuality, I think, is something beyond, much beyond, self-centered egoism of every person for themselves. This list of characteristics of individuality is compiled from the thought of Carl Jung, Abraham Maslow, and Carl Rogers, and though they use different terms for it, Jung especially individuation, Maslow self-realization, Carl Rogers self-actualization, but they all seem to be talking about something very, very similar, a person with these characteristics, someone who exhibits creativity, originality, and uniqueness, is self-directed. Particularly, they all agree, not limited by what society accepts, by the social norms, not limited by the urge and pressure for blind conformity. Someone who embraces change and challenges with self-confidence and courage, accepts responsibility and adheres to high values, is aware of his own innate potentials, which distinguish him, but also aware and recognizing and respectful of the capacities of other people. Not just living for himself, but preeminently a member of the society trying to contribute to it, living in harmony within himself and society. Now maybe this description, undoubtedly this description, is a pretty idealized version to tell us one pole of what a fully mature or developed individuality would be. And clearly human beings fall everywhere along a spectrum. But when we talk about a movement or an evolution towards individuality, I'm trying to suggest that we are moving in this direction. There are many different types and expressions of individuality, and I've just listed up a few of the more obvious ones here with a few examples, just to be clear that we're talking about people in all walks of life, in all types of activity, mental people, spiritual people, those who are socially, politically active, even those who have been physically courageous, and whether it's to go to the new world or to go to the moon. How is individuality formed? It's a topic that we need, I hope we'll spend a good deal of time on. The individual, I think, is not an exception to the norm. He's not some mutant or mistake or something totally unrelated to the society. The individual is one who carries within himself and embodies the accumulated knowledge, skills, and capacities of the collective, and is able to put them together in his own personality and express them in a unique and a creative way. What is exceptional are not so much the things he does or she does or says, but the freedom and courage with which these people explore, create, invent, recombine, and express the collective endowments of all society in original ways. In that sense, the individual is a conscious font of the accumulated knowledge and wisdom of all of humanity. The relationship between the individual or the single microcosm, but the society consists of these two in relation to one another. If we look back historically, conformity and subordination seem to be the essential requirement for the establishment and survival of any collective. First, the collective has to ensure that it can keep everybody on the same page in order to ensure its integrity and its security. But as societies develop, they experiment more and more with giving freedom to creativity and initiative of individuals, which not only leads to the development of the individuals, but to the development of the society itself. And I have listed, not in a very serious categorization here, stages to indicate the changing relationship between the individual and the collective, because I think it's moving in a discernible direction from pure conformity, whether forced or through loyalty, through what is called in democracy the first generation human rights, and now more recently the second generation socioeconomic and cultural rights that we accord. And I want to raise the question, what would an individualized society, what would a society be like that to maximum extent? How would it be like, and how would it be different from the society that we know today? Another very interesting question is, what is the role of the individual in the development of the collective? Individuals did not develop the world. The world has been developed by a collective effort of humanity. But we can't minimize this remarkable contribution of a few outstanding people. I've suggested here, very briefly, I think three important steps in that process, because when we look at new developments in society, I think invariably we can say that the first expression, a new idea, a new value, a social innovation, a discovery or a creative action, it starts with an individual. It starts in an individual mind, expressed by an individual, and acted on by an individual, whether on behalf of an institution with which he's involved or influences. At a later stage, people take note of this action. They may ignore it, they may ridicule it, occasionally, and often they, in the past, they persecuted it. Eventually, if the society is ready, it imitates, replicates, and multiplies by other individuals the new behavior, the new ideas, the new values. And eventually reaches a stage where the society as a whole, in increasing concentric circles, accepts, endorses, organizes, and institutionalizes what the pioneer initiated, until it finally becomes a part of the established culture and values of the society. I think this is a general direction that we see prevalent. What are the conditions favorable for the formation of individuality? Another very interesting topic to explore. And I think there's a parallel with what I've said already. For a full emergence of individuality, physical security for many people, maybe one individual can thrive even under very challenging physical conditions, but if we really want to create lots of individuals, physical security, political freedom, social equality, economic security seem to be the base that society is increasingly providing. And as a result, is successfully creating or encouraging more people to come out and more fully develop their own personalities. Education is a crucial, important part of this, and a theme that we certainly must come back to in our future discussions. What type of education really promotes individuation? Can we teach, how can we impart the values and skills for leadership, entrepreneurship, and creativity to a very large number of people? Can we teach true rationality that does not accept the conventional wisdom just because it's conventional? These are questions to be explored that would be very important if we come to a consensus that individuality is something that we should see more of, and we should try to promote it in whatever way we can. And how do we build the cultural values that promote a shift from social conformity, here I've said, to rationality? Because I think one of the defining characteristics of an individual is that he accepts something not just because many people say it, he accepts it because he rationally believes it makes sense and it's true. Today's society, even today, we're ruled very largely by conformity to the social consciousness of the collective. We don't like to admit it, but it's very hard to go against what everybody else believes, whatever it may be. And still, social power resides with those who agree to conform. We're not yet at a point where that has changed. The challenge for us is, how do we emancipate the individual from subordination to the social consciousness which oppresses and constrains individuality? Conscious individuality can proliferate, I think, only when society respects the courage and vision of those who refuse to conform and is willing to endorse rational propositions even when they conflict with prevailing social conventions. I'm going to wind up now with this question. Is individuality evolving? If we think back 500 years ago, even reading and writing was a rare endowment. The phenomenal achievements of the scientific revolution were really a handful of inspired individuals take credit for a good deal of it. Today, in contrast, we have thousands of inventors and entrepreneurs and scientists working more than ever before, many, many times more than ever before. Is it a trend? Is it a direction? Can we imagine a world in which individuality evolves from the rare exception into a common endowment, even if it's for a long time an endowment of a relative minority? A few hundred years ago, the French utopian socialist Charles Fourier predicted that a day will come when the world will have 37 million Newtons, mathematicians equal to Newton, 37 million poets equal in their artistic capacity to Homer, 37 million dramatists, being a Frenchman, he said, equal to Molière. Was he an inveterate dreamer, or did he really see into the future? And does this have implications for us, for WASP as an organization? Because we see that it's not just single individuals, but small groups of individuals can make a disproportionate impact in the world. A group like the Club of Rome, which has changed our thinking. Won the Nobel Prize for their work on nuclear abolition. Wikipedia, started by a couple of guys, now having 20 million articles, 100,000 contributors, and about 365 million readers. So groups like WASP also can make a great difference. What would we need to be as an academy in order to do this? Now, our format for today is we'd like to save the discussion and comments until after all four speakers have presented. But if there's any direct questions about what I've said, anything you'd like clarification on, so we don't go to a discussion based on with a lack of clarity, we can take a question now, otherwise we proceed to the next presentation. Now, if you'd like to ask a question, the right format is to click the raise hand button, which is at the bottom right hand of your screen, and I will try to see you. If I don't, you can demute your mic and just say, okay, Patrick, I see your hand. You can turn on your mic and raise your question.
Gary, can you hear me?
Yes, very clearly.
Okay. Can I ask a question now or should I wait?
If it's a question about what I've said, please do. If it's on a more general subject, let's wait till the discussion period, if that's all.
Okay. So what you said, you covered the several elements and it comparison to individuality and the individual. Do you look at the concept of individual in a religious context in terms of finding salvation and the meditation and that sort of thing in a individual realm?
Well, I think it's an excellent question. I did put in my categories a category called spiritual individuality, and that is a topic that the organizers in Montenegro were particularly interested in. So I would say either is such a thing as spiritual individuality also is in itself a big topic, I think. So that would be, we can have mental individuality in which the person distinguishes himself by their capacity for original thinking. We could have a social individual who distinguishes themselves in their capacity for social leadership and in innovation. And I think there is also scope, yes, to helping human beings discover their greater spiritual potential. Interesting question. Any other, thank you, Patrick. Zbig, can you turn on your mic?
I have a question related to the venues, social venues in which individuality is evolving, developing. So you have mentioned feudalism, monarchy, and then democracy. What about totalitarian communist system? Where do you place them to? Feudalism,
well,
significant
good question.
Humankind, communist rules. Thank you.
Very good question. Very good question, and very valid. I think, to me, it's obvious that the totalitarian is almost the complete eradication of the value of the individual. Except unless, of course, you happen to be a leader, but we're talking about as a social value, where the state, the collective, is given all importance, and the individual is really a cog in the wheel. So it would so I think it's almost the antithesis of the situation in which the individual is free and fully encouraged to emerge. Now, maybe my statement is a little too strong because though freedom of political expression is not provided, social security may be better provided under some such systems at some times than it is under some forms of democracy. So maybe it requires more thought than I have given it. But I think there is a basic negation of the value of the individual by the deprivation of basic rights. Good questions, Big, and maybe we'll have others to discuss that. Winston and Roy, I see you have both your hands up. Winston?
Just a brief comment, which is a rider on that, and that is, when people use the term collective, which you've used, you know, it carries a subtle and not obvious meaning to some, which is the collective really is meant to represent a super individuated phenomenon, which creates the element of hierarchy implicitly. On the other hand, you could also look at the collective as a many individual phenomenon, which therefore also carries the implication that as a many individual phenomenon, there's obviously space for individuation. And then one of the aspects of evolution that you mentioned was the evolution that would maximize individual autonomy and creativity and so on. And again, one of the implicit things there is that the more individuals maximization of their autonomy and respect will also represent a shift in power relationships, so that the established group is going to feel you're empowering the other side. And that brings in the importance, if you like, of an acute political analysis, as well as the importance of a legal analysis to rational and more constructive.
Very interesting comments, both Zvig's question and your comment. And I think what I was intending to do was raise a topic, and we deeper exploration. I'm taking just one more question, and then we'll go on to the next. Turn on your mic, please.
Gary, can you hear me?
Hi. Yes. Yes.
I notice sometimes that certain things happen where conformity and individuality kind of break out at the same time. I'm thinking about something like Facebook, where hundreds of millions are rushing to use the feature, which seems like a conformity, and yet it's also a place where everybody can express their individuality. So I was wondering if there's some kind of strange process going on where these both break out at the same time, and maybe that is a certain thing to address.
It's a wonderful question, and I'm going to think about it, right? You've given me something to think about. Excellent. So I have to be careful of these dichotomies. They're dangerous. Thank you. Okay, then I'd like to turn the session over to Ivo for his presentation. Ivo? Can you turn on your mic, Ivo, please?
Do you hear me now?
Yes, very clear. Thank you.
All right, sorry for that. It got off somehow. Whenever we say the word capital, it typically, in our mind, connotes the meaning, the concept of financial capital. However, even Adam Smith, when he speaks and writes about the capital, does have several aspects of different capitals. Nowadays, actually, we are distinguishing the natural capital, including maybe what we want to say on one side, the physical, but on the other side also the biological. So we speak of all of the wealth that we get from the Earth and possibly the planets, and how far do we go when we go outside. And then, of course, we speak about the biodiversity, all of the food, and so on. And, of course, there is in between both the water and the air. And then, of course, there is a category of human capital, and it is the human capital, including also the social capital, which is what we are discussing at the moment under this general title of the emerging individual. And let me just say that it is the hope, the aim of some of us in the World Academy, that as Pugwash had this famous slogan, and the slogan being, remember your humanity and forget the rest, and the Club of Rome has its slogan in a way, and that was the limits to growth, and the concept that everything is connected to everything else. So we in the World Academy should come to something like the human capital being actually at the source, at the root of everything that we want to accomplish. Now, I will not go into details of that, but obviously one aspect, which is in the title, deals with the question of education. And it is the education which actually enriches the human capital. And the question, of course, that we have to look, there are several of paradoxes. One paradox, of course, is that in a global world, interconnected global world, one would actually have the feeling that the collective overwhelms the individual. On the other hand, we do see much more of the individual coming out. So in a way, is one contradiction. The other aspect of the contradiction, of course, is the way the education is the basis which helps us to come with the new ideas. But on the other hand, certain aspects of education do provide, to some extent, a fixed pattern, which, of course, as has been said previously by Gary, and as we are all aware, breaks what is the dominant worldview. But without the existing paradigm, there is no way of breaking the paradigm. So the question of the human capital and education is also very much linked with the individual and the collective. As I said, these few words here are meant only to stimulate this discussion for our conference in Montenegro, so I won't go much longer than this. I will just mention that Gary and I published a paper which is available in this journal Sustainability under the title of the Human Capital and Sustainability, that even in our articles that we have been putting forward in our journal Cadmus, we actually address the question of how to measure the human capital. Namely, while in the case of the financial capital, and even in the case of physical and biological capital, we tend to use the concept of money as a reasonably good method in measuring the human capital. This is, in a way, a possibility. We can measure always the money needed to achieve a certain degree, the time spent, and so on, but is hardly an adequate thing, and obviously much more is needed to even address how to measure the human capital. And of course, unless one is capable of measuring something, to paraphrase what Lord Kelvin said, unless you can measure it and quantify it, it is, of course, not that easy to discuss the question. So the full discussion of the question of human capital and education is, of course, intimately linked with the question of defining indicators of how to measure both of them. Now, in conclusion, let me just once again emphasize our desire to put the human capital at the core of the project of the World Academy, to emphasize there several aspects that are obviously present: the economic, ecological, and moral crisis that we are now in, the crisis that we are obviously facing with our political system, the question of having ideas, creativities, the question of cultures, values, and spirituality. And all of these things should, of course, be present as we are approaching the question of the human capital. So these are actually just some of the brief thoughts. If there is any comment, I don't think there is much need for questions now, because I didn't say anything that was that presumably prompts any of the questions. But if there is anything, I would be delighted to reply. So please, if there is any comment. If not, then we turn to Winston with okay, can we go to Winston?
I'll just make one brief comment, Ivo. I don't see any hands up. And that is just to add to what you said, that in the paper we were working on human capital and sustainability, we actually came to the conclusion that the only long-term solution to changing the way human society behaves is to look for consciousness towards greater individuality. That was one of our conclusions there. So human capital covers the whole spectrum from the basic knowledge and skills necessary to be a productive member of the society, all the way to the other end of being one of the creative original thinkers that are going to lead us into new ways in the future. So it really covers, that's why it's such a wonderful concept for the Academy, because it embraces the full spectrum of what needs to be addressed. Okay, then, Vic, is that the new hands, Vic, or the one you had earlier?
If I may add, you know, I am an economist. I see, each capital should produce benefits, because otherwise we shouldn't call it a capital. So, I mean, that the human capital is, I agree everything what you said about the significance of the human capital. But besides the skills and knowledge, and I think that we should add the attitude, we have also that type of human capital which is institutionalized. It is institutionalized, for instance, in academia. I mean, the university is not the building. These are the people who are working together. They are binded by the idea. And then, you know, as an economist, I look from the point of view that, you know, this is the changing category. I mean, there is a depreciation. So we need to, you know, capital means something accumulated to serve, to meet the needs and respond to the challenges. So it means, you know, we are sacrificing, building human capital, we are sacrificing on contemporary consumption for the future gains, you know, gaining some knowledge, learning some skills, you know, to get some benefits, you know. So, well, you know, if you look at it from this point of view, there is certain depreciation because there are innovations and certain skills and knowledge is disappearing. We need to think about, you know, the category investing in human capital is and depreciation. These are the processes we need to be aware. And then education is the process. It's like manufacturing in producing cars or planes, you know, education is the way. But, you know, we need to also, and the universities are the very important type of institutionalized capital. I mean, I used to work with Professor Shu and Patrick probably remembers him, you know, so he was really, you know, writing about this institutionalized capital, which is somehow not easy to replace or renew. You know, it takes a generation to make a good university. We need to think about in this. And the last one, there is a type of unique human capital, you know, and people without any education, but they have these genial ideas or entrepreneurship skills, we need to also consider. So anyway, so these are elements I am writing to complement your article, and I hope that we can discuss as in Podgorica or on the line, you know. Thank you very much for bringing this issue.
Thank you.
We should work around human capital in the academia as the main topic.
Yes. Absolutely, and you have actually enlarged much more than I have said in my few words all of these aspects. Of course, the human capital is at the same time a source of all of the other capitals that we have, because we have iron until we realize how to really dig this from the earth in our minds, how do we process it, and so on. We don't have, obviously, anything, even technologies, until we actually put this human capital in. The financial capital, the money itself, is one of creating the society, and that is the capital in itself, not capital, about, besides human capital, we speak also about the social.
Is a, in a sense, derivative of the two previous papers, and it's giving a particular a gloss onto the idea of human rights from a of a planetary concern. Now, I wanted to just also mention that, in my view, the adoption of the human rights instruments was quite a revolution. Which resulted in the exit of the dictator president of that country. Next door was Egypt, and Hosni Mubarak experienced the same thing. And then viewpoint, self-determination, and ultimately essential dignity. And the human rights process is one of the most important instruments of empowerment for precisely this kind of focus. Formulate the complex structure of values in ways that are extremely manageable, and also target the values to those institutions that are meant to facilitate their realization.
He's at the university, so we would expect their DSL lines to work pretty well.
Individuality, which I value myself very highly, is more a philosophical question that has to be resolved in its own right. I think it's very dangerous to
which he touched on very lightly given the time constraints, but one of the contributions of Laswell is, Winston keeps using the
baskets up into the human rights articulator and demander of values. And then the question is how to make that form of humanistic advocacy and dynamism developing the facts about human rights problems are accurate and persuasive. Similarly, with regard to the promotion, you want to also sell the decision. that from a global point of view, it's one of the most important institutions that makes the individual, not the collective, the critical stakeholder in the realization of its promise. Defense of the fundamental human rights values. Thanks.
Please turn on your mic.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Brief question or clarification. You look at it very Western, post-enlightenment way of looking at the human rights and individuality or individual. How does it play out with like computer files?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. Could you repeat that?
Okay.
We're not able to hear your sound. We're not hearing you.
Can you type it out?
Can you type it out in chat? Sure, let me try.
I can hear
now you. It may be all right, Patrick. Try again now. It just may have been a temporary.
Okay, now I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, go ahead now. Restate your question.
Okay. You look at the human rights and individual in a very Western post-enlightenment paradigm, like we used to think about it. How does it fare with the concept of group concept in a society which is paramount, like in the Confucius societies, like in East Asia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. First of all, I think the question is where one approaches this from. If you approach it from the basic values, and then the power, wealth, respect, enlightenment, and so on, health and well-being, these values were actually drawn from anthropological experience cross-culturally. And so people with the right lens could find that no matter what the cultural paradigm, there are certain constants related to people's needs and people's basic aspirations. And those reflected these in their... That's really where that comes from. Then second, if you take the entire Bill of Rights, the discourse has frequently said, well, the Western aspect of this is it's concerned with civil and political rights, but it has a certain amnesia for social, cultural, and economic rights, and maybe even an amnesia for solidarity rights. That is still a continuing debate in which I think the third world perspectives have become far more important in shaping the way we look at human rights in a holistic sense. Now, I'm not sure whether if you said that the tradition of political articulation, which in many ways is dramatically influenced by the Enlightenment, is sort of exclusive to the Western tradition. the fact of the matter is that the Indian independence movement, long before we had an International Bill of Rights, was vociferously essentially advocating and using all the tools of advocacy to achieve freedom and justice and independence for the Indians. And indeed in South Africa, before the Universal Declaration was drafted, the ANC, African National Congress, drafted its petition of right. And this was done 6 or 7 years before. And the petition of right, if you compare it to the Universal Declaration, tracks it. But it was really very much an African product. And in the jurisprudence, at least of the South African Constitutional Court, the court has found the equivalences of human dignity in the African cultural tradition, in the concept of Ubuntu, you see. So I think that there's the part, the idea, at least in my view, of some governments of the third world, namely that that they don't need to take note of human rights because human rights are not a sufficiently inclusive global product. I think that's an excuse not to confront the problems of human rights. What's the difficulty? Well, the difficulty, frankly, is that socio-economic rights frequently condition the delivery of political and civil rights. Similarly, civil and political rights have a core interdependence with social, cultural, and economic rights. So the rights are really very interdependent, and of course there's an intellectual challenge for a group like us to be able to have skilled tools of investigation and expression to clarify precisely what the specific issues are in the different cultural contexts.
Great. Okay. Any other questions for?
I don't know if you mentioned Confucius, but you know, Confucius was one of the earliest of the human rights advocates, and he was certainly an advocate of good governance, and he was an anti-corruption man, and so on. And then the great Indian Emperor Ashoka. If you read some of the edicts that we have that still survive, you'll find that that the edicts of Ashoka have many, many of the modern human rights principles in them. Sorry.
Interesting. Was there anybody else with a question for Winston? Okay. Well, we'll have more time at the end then. Let's go to our final presentation by Janani. Janani's a new associate fellow of the Academy. We welcome her. Janani?
Yes. I thank you.
Please.
Good morning. I'm Janani Harish, associate fellow of the World Academy of Art and Science. First, I thank the Academy for electing me as associate fellow, and I eagerly look forward to participating in the Academy activities and trying to contribute. The name of the World Academy implies that there is a common ground between the arts and sciences that can be applied to address global, social, political, and economic issues with which the founders of the World Academy were deeply concerned. Yet it is not immediately obvious what role the arts can play in addressing these issues. We clearly see scientific research empowering us to harness the forces of nature. Technology has made it possible for us, each one in a different part of the world, to meet and discuss today. Study of economics or politics can result in reforms that improve the conditions of humanity. Literature, as all arts, appeals to our senses. But when we see its aesthetic value, we are looking just at the surface. Beneath is a treasure trove waiting to be discovered that reveals to us the distilled wisdom of humanity for us to understand, use, and benefit from. I would like to focus my comments on the contribution which literature can make to a deeper understanding of life, social processes, and human development. Literature provides greater depth of penetration into social processes than historical narrative or biography, because it portrays the psychological and social consciousness of the characters and the times with far greater realism and detail. For example, the lives of the factory workers at the time of the Industrial Revolution that changed the face of England and the world has been well researched and documented. But Charles Dickens' portrayal of David Copperfield adds a realism, a personal perspective of the situation, insights which a mere historical or statistical description cannot provide. Apart from being a story of adventure and romance, Alexandre Dumas' The Three Musketeers is a meticulous historical and social record that paints a vivid picture of the close ties between religion and politics in France, the concentration of political power accompanying the rise of absolute monarchy, the extreme detachment between the extravagance of the wealthy and the poverty of the common people that later turned to revolution, the broad prevalence of political corruption and the machinations in marriage, military governance and international relations in the 17th century. Dumas' description of the precarious warlike situation between countries precipitated simply by petty personal reasons is a lesson for the 21st century as well. Similarly, Jane Austen's famous novel, Pride and Prejudice, depicts the subtle impact of the French Revolution on English society and the profound changes in social attitudes and the relationship between the classes it silently rotten as England struggled to avoid a bloodbath of the guillotine that befell the neighbors. It depicts how England avoided violent revolution by peaceful evolution through intermarriage between the classes. Victor Hugo's portrayal of the spirit of revolution in 1830s in Les Miserables and Anthony Trollope's portrayal of 19th century English elections, corruption, and parliamentary politics in his Palliser series can be a powerful complement to objective analysis of external social institutions and historic leaders. There are ideas we understand about slavery from Harriet Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin and its abolition from Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind that are difficult for a research report to explain. Anna Sewell's Black Beauty, called the Uncle Tom's Cabin of the Horse, that describes the travails of work horses resulted in legislation protecting the animals and changed the mindset of people regarding the traditional and fashionable practices that caused much suffering to animals. Coming to a book of recent times, American intellectual Gene Sharp's writings on democracy and nonviolent action are the inspiration and guiding force of revolutions that have ushered in change in Tunisia and Egypt. If a man writing in Boston can influence people and initiate progressive changes in the far corners of Burma, Bosnia, and Zimbabwe, the role of literature does deserve serious attention. To focus on Pride and Prejudice, what can we possibly learn of relevance to contemporary social life from a comic story of romance and marriage? Jane Austen's story is entertaining, amusing, and the fairy tale ending leaves us feeling happy. But seriously, what is this all about? Pride and Prejudice is set in rural England at the turn of the 18th century. It is the lively tale of the fortunes of the Bennet family, consisting of Mr. and Mrs. Bennet and their five young daughters. Mr. Bennet is a landed gentleman of moderate fortune. Mrs. Bennet's primary concern is to get her girls married. The arrival of a wealthy young man causes a stir in the neighborhood. This young man, Darcy, belongs to a distinguished family and takes great pride in his status. He is attracted to one of the Bennet girls, Elizabeth, but he is so steeped in class consciousness that he is unable to accept his own feelings. How Darcy resolves his inner conflict and is united with his love forms the chief part of the narrative. At first, repelled by Elizabeth's modest status and inferior connection, Darcy tears himself away from her. But as if by the winds of change blowing in the land, he is brought back to her again and again. Gradually, he learns to look beyond superficialities of status, family name, birth and fortune. He recognizes what true value is and begins to value Elizabeth's strength, intelligence and goodness. He sheds his sense of superiority, stands up to his titled relatives, who opposed such a match that breaks from tradition, alters his value systems and wins Elizabeth's heart. The story, seen at the surface level, is the tale of Darcy marrying Elizabeth. But behind this romance lie powerful truths. Mrs. Bennet's plan to secure wealthy husbands for her daughters and Darcy's steward son's ambition to rise to the level of his master are instances of a social movement, the awakening of aspirations in the people from the lower rungs to climb up the social ladder, a faint echo of the revolution raging across the English Channel. Had Darcy spurned his employee's ambition or scoffed at Elizabeth and her family, not only his life story, but even the history of England would have been different. But Darcy saves his head and symbolically that of the entire aristocracy by daring to break away from the deadwood of convention, accommodating the aspirations of those below and attuning himself to the changing times. Wily relatives, unexpected setbacks, and the prevailing social norms together create what seem like impossible, hopeless situations. At each stage, the protagonists exhibit a strong element of individuality and the cumulative effect of these isolated incidents, of an aristocrat shedding his pride, a village girl refusing to be intimidated by his powerful relatives, of people who dare to differ and think for themselves, is that society evolves. So this cheerful love story depicts England's subtle response to the French Revolution and the peaceful, progressive evolution that was effectuated in England. More specifically, it depicts the role of formed individuals in bringing about radical social change. For the one thing Darcy and Elizabeth share is a willingness to transcend the prevailing values and behaviors of their time, to act out of deeper personal convictions which place them in conflict with the societies in which they live. Like her creator Jane Austen, Elizabeth Bennet is the prototype of the modern woman who has the courage, strength and individuality to reject the material and social security of a respectable marriage, to search for something higher and truer, even at the risk of failure and ostracism. I'd like to conclude with the observation that Elizabeth achieved it by social elevation through marriage. And Jane Austen never married, but she attained it 200 years later by literary immortality.
Thank you, Jenny. Questions for Jenny before we open it for general discussion. While somebody you're thinking about, oh, there's a question, Merlin. Please, is that a new hand, Merlin, or the old one?
Yeah. Did I put a new hand up? I didn't realize I had. But,
well, the hand, maybe it was still up, and maybe it was the old one.
Well, I think just a comment on the role of literature and also the other arts, many arts such as theater and television and film and so on, in my view, is absolutely crucial in terms of its impact, of its larger impact, probably a bigger impact in many ways than anything that's terribly literate. And abstract, And so I fully support what the speaker was saying.
Thank you. Roy, I see your hand. Please turn, yes.
That was a wonderful presentation, and the aspect of coming through, expressing through literature will be very helpful in our pursuits of this topic. The question I had was, in the explanation we saw that in the case of Pride and Prejudice, Darcy expressed his individuality, Eliza did as well, through the pressures of life. So the specific question is there a way we can consciously learn individuality in some way that we, rather than waiting for difficulty, that somehow it can be a learned occasion, whatever, that we can learn to apply our individuality or see through situations? And for an answer, I put the question in there.
Very provocative question, too. Do you want to answer?
Question in this?
Can we acquire individuality without waiting for dire circumstances that demand it of us? Good question. Any other? Yes, Ludmilla has a hand up. Please turn your mic on.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Hello. Mila, I go by Mila, it's easier.
Mila, thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of comment and add somewhat to Janani's presentation in terms of questioning the position of arts or literature in its capacity to contribute to our worldview. It's unquestionable, just like Merlin was talking about it, Dr. Donald. Because it's not something that we live off of, but it gives the meaning to what we live off of, and it gives the meaning to the way we live, which is an essential need, not only the need to survive, but also to contribute and to leave legacy and to add meaning to life. In that sense, we have a need for transcendence as well. So I wanted to put that out there as the idea that reality that we live and art in which we recreated is a mutually productive, are actually mutually productive domains, that art imitates life and life ends up emulating art as well, being fashioned after life. In that sense, literature and art offer us a model, a chronotopic model that is a time-space capsule that allows us to be able to sort of examine and mess with our life and experiment with our lives within that time-space capsule, while it also gives us a universal expense, a sort of a universe in a nutshell, within which we have the capacity to view a whole network of relationships and bigger picture and greater vision within the time-space capsule. So that's something I wanted to sort of add to the discussion, so that we don't have to start from the groundwork of having to establish the role of art ever again. Like that's not going to happen. I'm joking, but I wanted to point that out. One of the most interesting things to me, of course, was what Dr. Nagan was talking about, and I'll just sort of put that out as a comment and as a question that binds these two presentations, is the notion of the aesthetic right. I find that very fascinating. Not only that we have these basic needs and aspirations and the rights to demand fulfillment of those, but the idea of solidarity rights as well as the aesthetic rights that we have, the right to enjoy our life as well as to create beautiful things, if whatever our notion of beauty is, but that we have the right to enjoy it and be productive in the creative way in the world, and to that is fascinating to me, and I would like to invite Dr. Nagan to talk about that for a minute. And I think that's key here, that expands our notion of rights as well as needs and aspirations at the same time. So I would like to invite Dr. Nagan to comment about that. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. I put it in there realizing that there was some controversy about defining it precisely. But it seems to me that I was moved by a very simple idea, that the essence of being human has a transcendent and a creative component to it. And if there's a point in cherishing individuality, it has to do in part with the nurturing of this element of transcendence and creativity in us. So that, I, in my view, was so fundamental that it was worth putting in there. Now, I also have worked with some of my colleagues who have been working in archaeology, and they've tried to see the importance of archaeological findings, particularly those that have artistic merit, as being very crucial to the sense of self-identity of the culture, and hence they see that there has to be some fundamental recognition of cultural rights as being part of well, I think one of the most stunning paintings that I've ever seen was Picasso's Guernica, which so captured and of course Dickens, I think I learned more about the French Revolution reading A Tale of Two Cities because he made it very real and you get that feel that maybe you can't I can't say that everyone thinks we have this aesthetic right, but I certainly do, and I'd like to promote it, and I hope the Academy would like to promote it as well.
Thanks. Listening to Winston's presentation and then Janani's, as I understood your point, Janani, you are not trying to justify art per se, but justify integrate the arts into our investigation. I think you did that very ably on the issue of individuality and social evolution or social revolution. Correctly, Winston. The demand advocacy was a crucial aspect of that. You also talked about Laszlo's emphasis. You gave it to us as the theory of the process, and what I thought I heard in Janani's narrative on Pride and Prejudice was that she was actually illustrating it in the actual process in a story of how an individual demands values by the types of decisions they make. My question to you, Janani, is whether I have understood that correctly, and whether you could maybe illustrate that in what way the decision of any of the characters, whoever you're referring to, affirmed the value of their individuality or affirmed a value other than the prevailing value of the social order by the type of decision they made.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. At that time, the end of the 18th century, until then actually the prevailing social norm in England, especially for the upper classes, the aristocracy, the nobles, the landowners, were a woman had to marry, a girl had to marry and marry well. And everybody, all the girls, the girl's moms, we all only looked at a man as looked only the fortune of the man while trying to get a match for her daughter. And here in the story we find that Darcy was 200 times higher financially than Elizabethan scale. And he proposes to her at first, Darcy proposes to Elizabeth. And at that time Elizabeth is mistaken. She is prejudiced against Darcy, which is part of the title of the book, Pride and Prejudice. He is proud and she is prejudiced. And so she believes that this man has wronged her sister, this man has wronged his steward's son. It was not his fault, there was a misunderstanding, but she believes that he does not have values, and so she refuses to marry him. She turns down that proposal, which is something that very, very few girls could do. Her family's position, especially if you see her property is entailed to a cousin. So only as long as her father is there, they have any property, they have a place to stay. Once, after her father's time, they have nothing to live on. But even in that state, she can very boldly refuse a very, very suitable, financially suitable match that comes. And so, in that situation, she, I feel, expresses individuality. She does what most people would not do in her time, and that is because she values character more than security, social security, financial security, and the comfort of a marriage. One example of Elizabeth expressing individuality in the story.
Very clear, thank you. So, through her decision, she demands a different value. She demands not just social security, she demands a man she can respect and love his character. And I guess that's what he ultimately delivers. Thank you. Okay. Ivo, you want to open it for a general discussion now? I think you were going to share that part. We have a little time left.
Just a minute, but unfortunately I will have to say goodbye somewhat earlier, and then Gary will continue. So please, do I see any hands? Anybody who would like to make any contribution?
Luke Miller has her hand up.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Hello to Dr. Slough, and also wanted to comment, and maybe at the same time, I know you need to be released early, but ask you about this notion of the crisis. When we were at the Montenegrin conference last time in 2009, one of the things we talked about is this notion of catastrophizing. So catastrophizing to the point of actually creating an opportunity for a new theory. Sometimes we stage certain crises and stage certain and catastrophes in our theories in order to be able to give birth to an idea or a solution, stage it for the solution. And I understand the actual basis of talking about the crisis in the world right now. But you mentioned, you talked about contradictions between greater interconnectivity and at the same time greater individuation in the world. At the same time, education is a fixed center, and it's something that does foster greater individuality. How can we conceive of restaging the threat continually and infusing us as intellectuals and others with this continual fear of we're on the brink of crisis, we've seen the many and we've recovered from many, that's true. How can we sort of fold in the idea of contradiction and the productivity in contradiction, the productivity in contrast that will somewhat soothe us in the moments of crisis, soothe us in catastrophizing so that we end up on top and end up continually being productive rather than
being petrified, as we, especially when you hear from the high pulpits of academia, discussions of crisis and catastrophe, that I'm sure will petrify people that are listening to us. How can we incorporate contradiction and contrast as that which is impetus for growth without terror, I guess?
Thank you, Mila. Do we have anybody else? Okay, it seems that close to 2 hours is always a long discussion. What I would like to ask the presenters, particularly Gary and Winston and Yanani, is to send to all of us their PowerPoint presentation. Gary actually showed us his presentation, and it was really presented. Winston prepared a paper that will be published in Cadmus, but that will take still some time before it appears. And I think since there are about 15 or so of us present, it might be just simple to forward to everybody a PowerPoint presentation of what we were, what you were presenting. Is that agreeable?
Sure. I think we've already circulated Winston's paper and Janani's.
And Janani's. So your.
And I will certainly send the PowerPoint.
Your abstract, so you can circulate this. This will be that.
Sure.
Okay. This is, as we said, the first in a recent series of webinars, and I think it's very successful. We had how many participants exactly? Actually, few of those that we have here on the list were not present. I don't think that Bogdan is present, and maybe a couple of others. But anyway, it is actually a fairly large number, and this is something that we really want to keep on continuing, involving junior fellow, associate fellow, and fellows of the World Academy, and of course, so far, mainly members of the Board of Trustees were the initiators, but we may let me just try to stimulate all of you to just come up with the ideas. At this meeting, Janani and Mila were among the most active, and I really welcome this very much. I think this is what we want. Again, another comment, this is by no means restricted only to the fellows of the World Academy. We do enjoy actually having everybody in this activity. So if you have colleagues that you think could benefit or be interested in the subject that we have, it would be good that, of course, in some way they are present. Okay, Gary, I turn to you, and you can then...
Just a couple of closing comments from my side. One, I want to be sure everybody knows about the Montenegro Conference. We already have 20... As big, I see a hand, and I'll give you a chance, promise. And Winston, I see your hand, too. So promise to both. We have up until March 5th to submit abstracts. Those of you who would like to participate in Montenegro already, we have 20 participants from the Academy for this conference, and it is quite possible that we will be organizing right after this conference another half day or one day of additional programming, which is yet to be finalized, but we'll inform you about it as soon as that is finalized. Winston, I wanted to ask you to just speak a few words about the publication that you're working on with regard to individuality, so that everybody knows this is the first of a new series for the Academy. So why don't you speak men's big, and then we'll just come back for a second.
Yes, we have created an electronic journal, And the first or several of the initial issues will be focused on the individuality thing. So if you have a paper that you'd like to submit, we have a board of editors that are even reviewing and reading up and so forth, that would be great. And just I wanted to add one more thing. Ludmila had mentioned the development of the sort of the human rights and aesthetics aspect, which I think is an important issue, but somewhat undeveloped. That would be quite a useful thing if she could apply some of her own thinking to that, and in the exchange of views, we may emerge with an important contribution there as well.
Thank you. And that the first issue of this electronic journal is on the topic of individuality.
Right?
That's right. That's the first issue.
And you're going to have a second issue, but depending on
right.
the quality and so on.
Right. Good. Okay, Sadiq.
I don't want to lose interesting question and comment by Ludmila at the end of our discussion.
Yes.
The role of the crisis and individuality. And, you know, the creativity contributes to the crisis. So somehow, yeah, we need to be aware, I mean, that the innovations are not only improving our world, but also creating the crisis. I mean, the financial market is an example of the went out of the control. Anyway, so I suggest that maybe we should have a session on the crisis, individuality, creativity in Podgorica. So
it's a very interesting idea. Actually, I don't know, Mila, if you know that. We did have, in fact, I thought your question was well appropriately directed to Ivo because he put up a proposal approved by the Academy and not yet implemented for a project that looks at the global crisis, and I thought maybe that's what you were alluding to. And if I understood your very thoughtful comment, why is it that we have to, what did you say, catastrophize things in order to get action on them? Well, I think it's a very valid point. There seems to be a certain great inertia to human life where it's not easy for us to move out of our established grooves unless the incentive is significantly intense. That may be sometimes a positive incentive. We see that in the business community, the innovation of technologies and so forth. But very often it's true historically that it has taken catastrophe to move us. Europe had to go through two devastating world wars before we could come up with a half-formed institution called the United Nations. That's a common experience, and I think I agree with Vic. It would be well worthwhile looking at how we could move to a paradigm where we don't need crisis in order to move ahead. My own feeling is that it is directly related to this topic of individuality, those who are not simply trying to conform to what is established, but who have a creative urge to do something better not only for themselves, but for everybody, don't need a crisis in order to know that things could be a lot better than they are today. So I agree with Vig, it's a topic that we should find the right occasion to explore. I'd like to also say generally that we knew that this 2 hours idea was thrown out and come under this broad topic of individuality. We hope that some of you will join us in Montenegro, but without waiting for that, we do have a forum on the Academy website specifically dedicated to the individuality project In the last notification you received an hour before the conference started, there's a link. This link is there in the email. We welcome you to post questions, to post comments, to share thoughts, to initiate some discussion, which we'll try to respond to, so that we can, if you go to the forum, you'll also see that there was quite a bit of activity earlier when we were running the e-conference on that. It's the same forum, but you're welcome to participate either under one of the existing topics or under create a new topic that you think is related to individuality. In fact, a number of them have come up tonight, which were not under the original view. And any thoughts that you have about what you think we should be exploring in Montenegro or what you think we should be exploring in future under the topic of individuality. Before we close, I have comments or questions from anybody. Ashok.
Elsa Porter
has left.
Yes, Elsa. Ah, I see. Ashok, did you have, you had your hand up, you were going to say something? No? Okay. I don't hear anything. Okay. Ashok, are you trying to tell us something? I don't hear you. You're not muted, but there's no sound coming. Your mic is not working. Mila, your hand shot up for a second and then went away. Is there something you want to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you, obviously, for a wonderful discussion, the organizers. And obviously, we don't have enough time for wonderful ideas that are circulating here. I would like to know if I will be seeing Dr. Nagan and Bosniar, as well as I know Dr. Jacobs, you will be there. I would like to know if I will be seeing you in Montenegro, because that will be a very good time to plan for meeting and sitting down and talking, maybe even outside of the conference and expanding on these ideas. I just like to check with if they will be there, because they seem to be really interested in it.
Definitely, Winston, I'm going to speak on his behalf. We won't let him escape. He's fine. Most definitely. We'll all be there. All the four speakers will be there. We look forward to meeting you there, Mila. Thank you for your active participation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. And since the show doesn't seem to be able to work in the audio, then I thank you all for participating. And we look forward to hearing further from you, your thoughts by email or in the forums on how we should take this project forward. Thank you.
And
have a good day or a good night. Bye now. Thank you, Winston.